Why are you wearing glasses? Are they new?
No, I wear them in front of the computer when I'm doing computer stuff.
You're so old. In a good way.
Shut up. Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and the odd bit of idle gossip. I'm your host, Kirsten McDermott, and sitting to my right is my co-host, Ian Mond.
26 times we've done this.
26 times. That's quite a lot.
It is. It's 2 years and 4 months. 2 years and 2 months. My math's slightly off. And not only that, this is obviously the last one for the year. So we've done a full year of podcasting.
Full 2 years of podcasting? Your math is really off.
Yes, we've done something. Yes, it's all a bit of a blur. Well, see, we didn't.
It is a bit of a blur.
It is a blur, but also we didn't do every month this year. We did, you know, 14 podcasts in one day, and another 11 on another day. It felt like so.
Yes, we stacked them up, and we took advantage of having wonderful people in the same city to record a few.
And before I forget, I want to thank Cheryl Morgan, who said a very nice thing about the two of us in her reading pleasures thing for Aqueduct Press. You know, ambling towards Aqueduct has their, and I've been reading those. Tansy's was very good too.
Oh.
Actually, they've all been good, but Cheryl said something nice about us, about the podcast.
Oh, nice.
Providing the most detailed analysis on books on the Podland. Which we do.
Podland. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Cheryl. Thank you for sending me the link, Ian.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Well, don't you have Google alerts on that tell you when Writer and the Critic pops up?
Well, yeah, it seems to be broken.
It, very much so. Actually, it didn't pop up for me. I just happened to be. Also, no, because that's bad, because you're not reading ambling on the aqueducty thing.
I've not been reading almost half my feeds this last couple of months.
Who cares what your excuses are? There are certain feeds you should read, even if you're very busy, and that's one of them.
Okay.
This is a very, very good site. And Timmy's really, really good, especially on the political stuff.
Okay.
And that's why I read it.
I'll catch up on that one. Unfortunately, when I get really slammed and I'm busy, it's always the interesting, lengthy, you know, intelligent blogs that usually get put aside for later because, you know, they're ones I want to read when I have time to think about them. So otherwise I just kind of look at, you know, cartoons and stuff.
And Twitter. And you've only been busy with a book that's just come out. We'll get to that later.
Yes.
We have to jump on that now.
Yep.
And the Stokers.
And
your day-to-day life.
Day-to-day life and about to move house. And
that's me.
Well, that's me too.
We move into the same house?
No. That would be totally awesome. We can like a 24-hour podcast.
My wife would slaughter me.
In the garage. We could make up a pod den, like a permanent studio. How cool would that be?
So we're both moving house.
We are.
I'm moving on Friday.
Wow.
Yeah. Which will date this podcast ever so slightly.
I'm not moving till February, so that's okay, but I have a lot to get done before then, which means, dear listeners, we're very sorry, but this is not only the last podcast for the year, but it's the last podcast for 3 months. I think March we'll probably be back.
Well, that's 2 months. Where are you getting 3 months from?
Okay.
Because it's December now. It's mid-December now. We won't podcast January and February, but we will podcast in March.
But it will be 3 months before they hear us again.
I'm doing maths again. Shh, wait. You could actually be right. Well, 12 weeks. Which is sort of like 3 months.
Which is like 3 months.
Yeah, yeah.
So, okay, yeah.
Look, listen, I just want to say I fought for you because I know you all want to hear us each month. And I said, we must be on January and February. We have to have content.
No.
Because they said, fuck off. And I said, all right.
I didn't say that. I just said, we can be on and it will be dead air because I won't have had time to read anything and there will be no content.
People just want to hear us. The books are irrelevant.
I don't believe that's
true. They want to hear
me
sing. Did you hear all the comments about me singing Summer of 69?
I think we should do a best of album.
I'm thinking of a few more songs.
I think you've got enough material.
Have I done We Built This City yet?
I've heard you sing that many times.
Yeah.
I don't know if you recorded it on the podcast.
No.
We can take requests.
Yeah. Well, I'm happy to take requests.
We should totally do that. Next year we should do a Writer and the Critic charity Christmas/Hanukkah/Festivus album and you can sing and I'll record and people can download it for $1 and we'll send all the money off to a charity or something.
Would you thought work? Of that now, didn't you?
I just
you?
Thought of yeah. that right now.
Yeah.
And that's. I think that might be one of those
Look,
ideas.
I'll do anything for charity, and I'll do that. Oh, I can sing Meatloaf.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God, I can do the ballads. I'm really good.
Listeners, I think this idea just took root.
Especially that really long one about Paradise on the Dashboard thingamajig. That one I'm really good at.
Oh, my God. Okay, we need to move on.
Okay.
Small announcement, actually.
Aside from all the others.
We would like to officially welcome a new podcast to Podland because we are king and queen of Podland. I don't know why I said that. Sean Wright, Sean the Bloggernaut, has just uploaded a brand new episode of his brand new podcast, which is called Adventures of a Bookernaut. And it's a whole series of interviews with different people. He's a lot more structured and organized than we are. He actually has like music introing and outroing each segment and stuff. It's very much more organized, obviously, than we are.
But heavily inspired by us, of course. Isn't that right, Sean? Heavily inspired.
So, yes, everyone, we'll have a link in the show notes and everyone should go and listen to it and check
and
it out.
And he is a great interviewer. You should
he's
hear
a very, very good interviewer.
He's Kate Forsyth interview.
He's been doing Galactic Chats for this year and they've been great interviews. So
yeah.
I'm quite excited about this new podcast.
You know what it is? He's very beguiling. Have you met Sean?
I've met him several times.
He's very beguiling.
You don't
expect him to ask the tough questions. And when he does, you start to, you know, just get a bit broken on me. No, it's more.
No.
The truth is he's a lovely person. He's a genuinely lovely
he
person.
Is.
Except no, he's a genuinely lovely person and he is easy to talk to, therefore
he
good
is.
Interviewer.
And he asks very good questions.
He does.
So welcome to Podland, Sean.
Yes, we expect you to do hundreds and hundreds.
Is that really what it's called? It's called Podland.
Well, it can work all in a Podland.
I think that's awesome. Okay. So we'll have a link in the show notes to the Adventures of a Bookernaut podcast for your listening pleasure.
So should we talk about Book Day?
Book Day. Oh, my Book Day.
And Jason's.
And Jason's, yes.
Okay, well done. Congrats on Perfections coming out.
Thank
today.
You.
Explain to me and Blood and what's it called?
Blood and Dust.
Blood and Dust,
which is Jason Neron.
I'm actually looking at Jason who's not glaring at now he's glaring at in the other room. But well done to both of you.
Thank you.
And do Jason's voice. So
thank you.
Yes, that's it. So did you know it was coming out today or not? I'm confused.
No, there was no official, like, this is the day it will be out. Our publishers decided late last week to upload both books pre-Christmas. And so they've sort of been doing that behind the scenes and they kind of went live over the last couple of days. And then people started blogging about my book, so I thought I should blog about it as well.
So this is the thing, in the digital world that we live in, this is basically a digital-only book.
They're both digital only.
In the digital world, mm-hmm. things can just be uploaded without the author knowing.
Oh, no, we knew they were getting uploaded.
But did you know it was today, though?
Well, it wasn't, that's what I'm saying, it wasn't like technically today. Today is just when I blogged about it. I think they've been up for a couple of days on.
Who noticed first?
On Amazon, I think Kobo went up today. Well, our publisher like sent us a link and said we're putting them up now. So
who noticed first of the people?
I think Sean the Bloggernaut may have blogged them.
How do people even notice? I mean, did it
actually? No, I think Jason blogged it first, and then I think Sean.
Oh, may have so the person you live with, also known as your husband,
yes.
Fan of, why did he tell you?
No, I knew. Before? I've been busy.
No. I get this feeling that you were actually in the dark about this whole thing. Jason's woken up.
I was not in the dark.
Found out it's out. Blogged about it. Told Sean. You're still asleep or in the toilet or making pancakes. I don't know what you're doing. Tansy's found out. A bunch of other people have started tweeting. You've still got no idea what's going on. And he's just milling around telling the whole world and hasn't bothered to tell you.
I knew. It was just on my list of things to do.
Yeah, list of things to do. I would have thought it would be top of the list.
I know.
Not on the mid or towards the bottom.
Have I told you how 2012 has been for me?
A freight train, yes. I read your blog, so I saw you said that. But, good book.
Thank you.
I've read it.
I know. You were one of my bitter readers. So
yes,
thank you for that.
I read the acknowledgments, and thank you for thanking Jules. She'll be very happy.
Well, she
for
gave
her pharmaceutical
me, she gave
information,
me chemical advice.
Yes,
that was very helpful.
Yes, which you didn't end up using.
No, I did.
Did
you? Totally did.
Oh, yeah, the stuff about the.
Hello, listeners. Sorry for the edit. Ian just gave a great big spoiler about the book, which I had to edit. So. Now we're back.
I did. That's a spoiler. It's like, but can I just say about that spoiler without giving it away again, so you have to edit this bit out? You rang my wife asking for specific advice before I got to that bit. So you spoiled me.
Well, you were going to be a beta reader anyway, so.
Great book.
Thank you. Thank you.
Very suspenseful and psycho. But it's more a character piece then, I would say, than an out-and-out horror.
Yeah, although we'll get to talking about horror, I guess, when we talk about one of the books we're critiquing this.
Oh, shit, are we doing that today? I thought we were just going to talk about your book for the next hour.
Oh, God, no.
Please finish.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying, like, horror is a very broad genre, and I think as an umbrella it fits in there. I sort of have been describing it as contemporary urban gothic, which probably is as good as a subgenre term as any.
It doesn't have that sense of, and this is not a bad thing, it doesn't have that sense of ongoing dread that your traditional horror novel's meant to have.
Mm.
It's because it's more about the characters and their interaction in the situation that they're in, and not this sense that there's a serial killer out there that they have to catch, or there's ghosts in the woodwork.
No.
But all that said, though, without spoiling it, there is a bit. There is a particular bit when you get to the last. Yes. Anyway,
yeah, that got you, didn't it?
Oh, fuck yeah. Really, really got me.
Yeah.
I was reading it. I know where I am. See, when I read these bits, I always remember where I was. I was on the tram, the number 16 tram going to work. It was in the morning too. And it really churned me guts.
Oh, there you go. Thank you.
Yes.
I'm going to take that as a compliment.
Yes. And also what you do really well, I don't know why we're spending all this time talking about you,
no.
But I just thought if people are interested.
I might edit these bits out.
No, don't. Don't. You can't. Future Kirsten, don't edit this part out. It seems like quite a simple narrative, and yet it's not. There's a lot of layers to it, and that's all I'm going to say.
Okay. Thank you.
And I haven't read Jason's book, but I bet that's got layers to it as well.
Jason's book is a rollicking vampire, outback vampire.
With no sparkles.
No, definitely no sparkles. Lots of sunshine, but no sparkles.
Okay.
I guess I'll provide a link to both of them.
Well, that's not a conflict of interest at all. So,
you know, this podcast has got to come in good for something.
All right. Well, so both of those are out. So you can buy them on Amazon, Kobo, I don't know, wherever else. They're DRM free, except probably Amazon.
Well, the publisher's releasing them DRM free. What Amazon and iBooks and whatever else they decide to do with them once they get them before they pass them on to the end user. No one has any control, basically. So so if you want them absolutely DRM free, you can certainly buy them direct from the publisher.
And $9.99 Australian?
Yes.
Each.
Yes.
So it's $20 for two fine books.
There you go. Thank you, Ian.
Okay. So now we're doing a nonfiction podcast.
We are.
Book number one is Evaporating Genres.
Yes.
Book number two is The Secret Life, I think it's what's it called? The Double Life of Alice B. Sheldon.
Yes, which is the James
Tiptree.
Tiptree.
What's
Jr.
it actually called? Is it James Tiptree Jr. Semicolon, like, The Double Life of Alice B. Sheldon?
I think that's what it would be.
Okay.
The Double Life of Alice B. Sheldon is the subtitle.
Yes, by Julie Phillips. Gary K. Wolfe wrote the essays in Evaporating mm-hmm. Genres with some help from Amelia Beamer. But before we do that, because this is our nonfiction podcast,
yes,
as requested by thousands of fans,
well,
maybe two, I thought I'd raise a couple of issues. I want us to address a couple of issues that have been bugging me for some time,
mm-hmm.
but I haven't raised because I didn't feel appropriate. And I thought, considering we're doing a nonfiction podcast,
mm-hmm.
why not raise them in the nonfiction podcast? So the first one is, and actually it really works well today because today's book day for you. You're an author.
Yes.
You've just written a book.
Well, I didn't just write it, but sure.
Knocked it out over a couple of nights and here it is. So you're a professional writer. You got paid for that, I assume.
Yep.
Yes. Okay. So what gives you the right as a professional paid author to criticise other authors' works?
What gives me the right?
Yes, you shouldn't. As a professional.
What takes away that right?
Well, okay, maybe nothing takes away the right, but under the code of ethics of professionals in the land of writing, you shouldn't be picking on other people's works. So in other words, we should stop this podcast.
Hang on.
I'm playing devil's advocate.
Is the land of writing like Podland?
A little bit. No. While I am playing devil's advocate here ever so slightly, it is an actual issue that a lot of writers deal with.
No, it is.
Kat Valenti, for example, told us in the podcast we did with her that she was going to stop critiquing other authors' books because
they got all sad panda.
They got sad panda. And because she didn't know when necessarily to stop when she criticised. It wasn't one of the.
She would write really lengthy critical analysis and of quite books.
Vicious
and often very passionate.
Yeah, I use the word vicious, but passionate's actually a better word. No, it is.
She would be passionately like pro the book she loved as well, but she would be equally passionate in shredding them if she thought that there was something really wrong with the book.
And she felt she had to stop. Hilariously and ironically, but possibly more hilariously, Adam Roberts, who is the last book she really ripped apart, which was Blue Yellow Tibia.
Yep.
He himself, who also is a professional author and also used to knock a lot of books and prose, also stopped doing it because he saw no value in it in terms of his career, and he just got a lot of shit and so thought, I may as well stop. I'm paraphrasing. He stated it a lot more eloquently than what
I'm
I've
sure
just said.
He did. There's a lot of I guess chatter out on the internet about how it's Thumper's mother, isn't it? If you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything at all. So you either just plug the books and yay, rah, rah about the books you love, which is fine. And if you just don't like a book, you just pretend it doesn't exist. I guess it's an emerging point of etiquette. I think it's something that's a great shame. But
you think
it's up
new?
To yes. I think ever since person first put mark on paper, there would
Well, there's always been critics, but we're talking about a specific type of critic, someone who also does that.
No,
act.
But artists have always been critics as well, like always. If we step outside of the arts, because, it's an emotional world sometimes, and there are sad pandas and precious flowers and all that sort of stuff and egos and it's a world which is fraught with that kind of stuff, right? Any type of creative thing, you feel very close to that. But, in academia, in other professions, it's your peers who critique your work and review your work and in the sciences and in all that stuff. And that's what advances the field is by people of, your peers essentially reviewing and critiquing your work and pointing out where you may have gone wrong and providing counterfactual arguments.
That's analysis.
And all that sort of stuff.
That's analysis. It's not creativity. It's not – essentially, it's a more objective field. Like academia is meant to be a more objective field than the field that you're currently working in.
But so what?
No, you're right. And I can undermine my own argument by saying, well, an argument is of itself – quite subjective because it's
absolutely.
Just an opinion.
Absolutely.
So I mean, I'm talking shit. I mean, obviously academia is the same as
historians rip each other new ones every day.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And often on points of fact.
Points of fact or interpretation of fact.
That's the key point. Yes, it's interpretation of fact, just like interpretation
exactly.
of a book
exactly.
or a piece of art or a TV show
and,
or whatever.
And the sciences do it with interpretation of data sets. Peers review each other's work.
Yeah, but they don't
it's
do
a
it
really
in the creative
valid,
world.
Important.
Yeah, on TV or in movies, if J.J. Abrams started shitting on someone else's film, it would be on Twitter, on YouTube, it would be
well,
on
there's,
everything.
There's a difference between, and I think here's where the line is. There is a difference between writing for example, a personal response to a book and saying, this is shit. I hope that author dies in a train wreck. And actually doing a critical analysis of the book.
Which might also include, I hope this author dies in a train.
No, it wouldn't, because
yes,
that
it would.
Wouldn't be part of, that would not be part of a critical
you can.
Analysis.
I've read, I like Cracked Moon's, she's not a professional author, but she's a critic, and she does say some pretty dark things about authors, but they're still critical.
She has some idiosyncratic turns of phrases, yes.
Yeah, but still critical, though. I wouldn't. Sure. See, it's very easy, and I mean, this is where I get really shitty, but anyone who says something a little bit, even full on, close to cyberbullying levels of anger, they're immediately either called a cyberbully or a troll. And that's unfortunate where criticism
it
has got to.
It is unfortunate. It is.
You can't criticise anymore without being labelled either unprofessional in the case of an author or a troll or a cyberbully in the case of someone like a Cracked Moon.
Look, I think there's a long, long, valuable tradition of authors, visual artists critiquing each other's work. And the critiques aren't always positive, and sometimes the critique is often in each other, like the work they produce. There's often a culture of critique within other work, in like in response to people's produced work. But there's a lot of critique in from writers who are also academics, or writers who are not academics, but you know, publish review, lengthy reviews and essay length criticism in publications. I mean, Margaret Atwood, Ursula Le Guin, they regularly publish lots of in-depth critical reviews in say The Guardian or The New Yorker and so on. It's a long-standing tradition.
The moment they say something pure and very negative about a very famous or well-known writer, it's everywhere.
So what?
And but it's not everywhere in the terms of let's continue the discourse. It's everywhere in terms of, ooh, that was a bit harsh. You shouldn't have done that. And death threats. And they go.
I don't think that happens in most cases.
You don't?
I don't think that happens.
So you don't
in most
fear
cases,
for
no.
your. No, I'm dead set here. This is not a joke. You don't fear for. Not your safety. I mean, no one's going to come here with a hatchet. But in terms of your cyber safety, so to speak, in terms of your Facebook being hacked or your Goodreads account or whatever, people saying nasty things about you on Twitter because you've attacked the latest, I don't know, China Mavel novel. I'm just going to pick out of the stars.
But I think that's the difference. I mean, I think there's a difference between attacking and critical analysis.
That's my point. What we do on this podcast will be seen by some people as attacks.
Sure.
How we destroyed Angel Fall in oh God, how long ago did we read that? Well. We were pretty damn savage on that book. I mean, yes, we quoted bits of it and that, but we were savage. And you know, there's thousands of Angel Fall fans, and I actually know one of them. Did you see posted on the Podbean?
Yes, on our yes.
Yeah, and got quite
didn't like the profanity.
No, didn't like the profanity. Fuck me.
Oh, stop it.
But you know, and I think we were, yes, pretty strong, but very fair in the fact that we backed up our arguments, but some people will get very upset by that.
Sure.
So your idea of, yes, well, it's got to be this, it's got to be that, doesn't work for everyone.
Yeah, but that's fine. I mean, that's called opinion.
Though?
It's called opinion.
Is it though? No, I'm serious. Is it?
Yes, it is called opinion.
If there are professionals out there who are willing to neuter their opinions or censor themselves, either for the sake of their career or for the sake of this concept called professionalism, what is going through their minds? I'm not asking you to read their minds, but it's distinct from this idea that we should criticise and we should be allowed to, us authors, other authors, should be allowed to because it's something that's done in academia and it keeps the genre alive.
It's something that's done in the arts as well.
Yeah, okay. And you know, I agree with you. It keeps the dialogue going, but obviously enough people view it as unprofessional. And I'm talking about other authors, forgetting fans, etc.
I don't know how many other authors view the practice, like – objectively, regard, you know, if you put aside the tone of certain critiques or whether they go into personal insult and so on like that, if you put all that aside, I honestly don't think there'd be too many professional authors who would be regarding the idea of peer critique as unprofessional. I don't think that would be the case, depending on how it's said.
Okay.
I honestly don't think that. I think there are a lot of authors who you know, at the two examples you've used, Kat Valenti and Adam Roberts, who have, you know, decided it's not worth the time and effort they put into that for some of the feedback they've been getting.
And it's a great tragedy because they're both great critics.
They are.
And we are
losing
critics like them because of, I think, and I know what their reasons are, and it's not necessarily the reason I'm about to give, but I think because of a number of sensitive people out there who can't take criticism.
Also, I will point out too that it's not always the other authors who it's often the readers of authors who take umbrage at a negative review or so on. So it's not necessarily an author gets a bad review and starts firing slings and arrows.
I remember on the Kat Valenti podcast we spoke about, among others, and how my mate Macca wrote a review of that where he was castigated at length by her fans, Joe Walton's fans, just distinct from Joe Walton.
And that's, I think that's a problem too. I mean, the internet is polarizing and anonymizing, and I think it's a great shame that people can't, A, divorce a work from the person who created the work. It doesn't necessarily reflect on the author as a person or even as, you know, career-wide assessment of what they do. And I think it's a great shame that there definitely is a culture out there that if I like a book, I will just get so angry at anyone who says that book is bad or that they just don't even like it.
Yeah.
And I think that's – I mean, why can't we just accept that people will like different things and like different things about different things?
Yeah, that's right.
And, I mean, you only have to go on – look up any famous book on Amazon, like any famous book, and there will be just thousands of one-star reviews.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't matter what the book is.
No, no, you're right.
And that's fine.
The tragedy of our current age, and it might be a tragedy of the last 2,000 years, I wasn't around, but the tragedy is that the one-star person and the five-star person are incapable, for a variety of reasons, to get into a dialogue as to the pros and cons of a particular book. That's why this podcast is so important for
Not
me.
Not always. I mean...
No, that's what I'm saying. That's why this podcast is so important, because when you love something and I don't, we can. I don't just go off in a huff.
No.
And you don't go on off and off. We actually talk it out.
And, whereas the internet, we don't sit there and I don't say, oh, God, you're so stupid for liking that book.
You do off microphone, but on microphone you don't. But seriously, we have that discussion. Unfortunately, the internet doesn't facilitate that.
It doesn't seem to.
It tries to, but it fails.
The internet, by its sort of hyperactive nature, it favours extremes of opinion. It doesn't favour a mediated, balanced discussion.
Yeah.
That's not going to get people linking and saying, oh, look at this mediated, balanced discussion. It's really quite intelligent and thoughtful.
Yeah, although you do get that from now and again. People say, yes, you can read the comments.
Usually it's like, oh, check out the flame war.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, check out what this person said about that book. You know, that's what gets attention, more so than...
It's true.
This sort of
I know people say it, but it's a shame that you can't read the comments. People say don't read the comments.
I know.
And it's a shame
because the comments
is where the dialogue is.
Yeah.
And that's where we should be, because that's what I want to talk about when we talk about the James Tiptree, Julie Phillips's book, the biography. It's so well written by Julie in the sense, and I'm skipping a bit here, but in how it brings out that there was a dialogue going on, an epistolary dialogue going on between authors. And they disagreed, and violently sometimes, and would get upset with each other. But it was there. It seems not to exist anymore. That's a generalisation. It probably does. But
no, I think it does. I think, as I said,
But I want to go back to that age where we had to handwrite or
handwrite
type out
letters. And
I think she did send it on
her letters
typewriter.
And comment.
Yeah.
Yes.
But anyway, I want to move on to the second point. Sorry.
So that was the first point.
Yeah. So we've only spent about an hour on that point. But the second thing I wanted to address was I'm a first author, and you're reading my book and you destroy it. The mental anguish to me as the first author, I may never write again because of how critical you were to my book. Should we take into account when we review, both on this podcast and others, the fact that we're here that criticism should be about also being constructive, helping first authors rather than forcing them to shoot themselves? Or never write again. And when I say forcing, I mean compelling.
Well, if we're going to look at it as like this specific podcast, most of the time we don't. The last two episodes were sort of an aberration in what we normally do, in that we got recommendations from other people, not you and me, and we were explicitly looking at self-published books, even though one slipped through that wasn't. And we normally don't do that. And I think, you do. I mean, we have reviewed, haven't we reviewed? We've reviewed a first book. We reviewed Lisa Hannett's first book on this podcast.
Yeah, her first collection.
Yeah. So we have reviewed first books before. You definitely take it into account. I know I do when I'm reading.
Do you? Who cares?
What do you mean, who cares?
I mean, why? If it's shit, it's shit.
Yeah, but I mean, look.
We were going to say, does everything have to be qualified? It's a shit book, but it's a first book. Therefore, it's only slightly less shit. I mean, no, it's still shit.
No. I think if the book has no real redeeming features, I mean, the best thing, again, probably would be not even to mention it. And normally that would be my thing.
Nah.
No, just I mean, seriously, if there's just nothing really worth discussion except how bad the book was.
Sorry,
you know,
I don't buy that.
There are too many bad books in the world to review them all.
I'm not saying we should go out and find bad books, read them, and then kick the shit out of them. I'm saying that if I've gone and reviewed a book, if you read it and the book is complete and utter dreck, yeah, fine. Rip it a new one. Why not? If you're reading it, you've spent 2-3 hours.
Well, that's the thing.
I think saying, no, I'm not going to do it because it's a first author is disingenuous.
I guess I'm more thinking of books that I've read that you know, I've liked, I've seen problems with them that I can sort of say, well, this is an author who's – this is their first book. They can – there's a lot of promise here.
Oh, that's separate.
And they're – you know, that's what I mean by taking into account. You do take into account the stage of an author's career when you're reading a book and what's come before. It, you know, if you're familiar with the author, it often builds a picture of their work. So you do take that into account. But no, I don't think in terms of like excusing a bad, like a really irredeemably bad book just because it's the first thing someone wrote. I don't think that gets excused by the fact that it is the first thing they wrote. And if it's been, you know, published by a third party, then you can kind of question the publisher for for putting it out there in that form. But, yeah, I don't think it is the job, again, you know, unless you're devolving into personal insult, which is not something that I'm comfortable with doing as a critic. I do like to separate the work from the author, except in matters of biography when that feeds back into the text, because then that can make a text richer if there's explicit biographical stuff yes. in there. But in terms of, you know, like taking what a character's like, what the book's like, and extrapolating what the author must be like, there's very little grounds for doing that upon reading a book. So, you know, that aside, if you take out, you know, any personal attacks on the author or criticism or extrapolation, I think it's open season on a book. A critic's job is not to think about whether the author's going to be a sad panda in the corner once they've read your review. If you're an author and you're inclined to be a sad panda, don't read what other people say about your work.
Write books.
Or don't write books, but, you know, like, well, don't read.
Because there's no fucking way that you're sending a book out.
No.
And you're thinking that every single person who picks it up is going to love it. You know, in spite of what Goodreads might tell you.
You'd hope not.
But there are obviously people out there who are... who just don't understand that concept, who don't have a thick skin at all.
Sure.
Have a very thin skin.
Sure.
Very insecure. I mean, I'm of the view.
And maybe they shouldn't be writing books for public consumption then.
Like when Alice Sheldon was writing in the early 70s, there was no ARPANET, and therefore, other than the letters that came in and out, she could actually be hidden from the opinions of the wider SF world if she wanted to. Me, it was actually easier.
Yeah, then. She didn't have to go and buy magazines and read reviews.
No, she could step out.
Sure.
And for all, it goes out there and sure. Who knows if people like it. Oh, wow, I won an award. Well, it's obviously someone liked it, although that's not how she reacted, but anyway, side issue.
But, you know, you don't...
But today it's very hard. No, today it's very hard to ignore it.
Well...
If you're on any sort of
you don't
device.
Have to set up Google Alerts. You don't have to follow links. You can ask your friends not to send you links.
Well, then why are you writing? I don't get why you're writing if you're not trying to engage with an audience.
That's another point. Look.
Anyway, we've probably gone a bit off topic anyway.
It's the thing. I think if you're writing a book for public consumption, not a book that you're passing around your friends and family or your, you know, your circle of whatever you have, you know, or you're putting it up as fan fiction on some forum.
Yeah.
Whatever. If you're writing a book and you're publishing it, whether you're publishing it yourself, as we discussed the last two episodes, or, you know, a publisher has taken it, you're putting that book out there. And what you're asking from people is to give you their time, which is finite.
Yes.
No one gets time back ever. It can't happen. It's gone. And it's the most precious thing anybody has is their time. They yes. could get money back somehow, but they can't ever get back the time they've spent reading your book. That's the deal you make. They've given you their time. They get to do what they want with that time. And if what they want to do is critique the book because they felt it was a waste of 4 hours, they get to do that. That's...
And
know,
actually, the time element—the time element—is actually bigger than the money element.
It's much bigger than the money element. Time is absolutely finite.
Well, so
it's the
so
one.
So is money to a degree, you know, proper economy. But yes, I agree. The time,
but, you know, like yeah, time—you never get time back. You can never make more time.
Yeah,
you just can't. You're right. Right? It's that person has given you their time and attention, and if they feel that was not well paid.
Yeah, I think you've got two options as an author. Either I'm allowed to vent and say how much I hated your book, or you have to sit locked up in a room with nothing for the 4 hours I wasted reading your book, or for however long it
took.
Putting
bamboo under your fingernails.
Yes, you have to. They're the options.
They're the options.
Yeah, that's what I think. But look, thank you for answering my questions.
I think that was a bit of a muddled discussion, but
Well, which of our discussions has been
that's very
non-muddled, true. Let's be honest.
I think, yeah, but look, basically, bottom line is you're an author, you're putting your work out there. You, A, can't expect everyone to like it. B, can't expect the people who don't like it to shut up about it. And C, can't expect to never see any of the things that people say when they don't like it. It's part and parcel of publishing or making art or being an actor or doing anything in the public eye that you present to people and say, what do you think of this? Sometimes what they think isn't going to be what you like to hear.
So you need to be more psychologically prepared? Because not everyone can be. Some people are.
Maybe.
Yeah, okay. And I should want to talk about more about psychology, obviously. Yeah. We'll talk about and we'll get to that.
It was an interesting discussion to bleed into these two books,
yes,
though.
Because, interestingly enough, Gary K. Wolf, don't know if you know him.
No, I've never actually met Gary, no. But his voice,
you went to World Fantasy, did you? Oh,
he wasn't
at that
there.
World Fantasy.
It wasn't there the one I went to. But his voice is so familiar to me. And it's funny because reading the book, I could hear cadences of his voice a lot of the time.
He talks and writes the same way.
He does.
It was like listening to Coot Street, Jonathan.
The more conversational ones, like the ones which were a bit denser.
Yeah.
I didn't hear his voice as much, but the more conversational ones, like there'd be a sentence or something he'd do, and I could just hear his voice.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It was a little off-putting, actually. Sometimes it was like he was sitting on my shoulder just talking
that's
at me.
Not just off-putting, that's pretty disturbing. So, anyway, he's a critic.
Yes, he is.
And he's probably faced a number of letter bombs, death threats.
I hope not.
There's probably people who won't talk to him in fandom because of what he – or, you know, writers who won't talk to him.
I think this is ridiculous.
Although he is, of the critics out there in the world of genre criticism, probably one of the more positive.
Yeah.
Because Locus obviously – not obviously, Locus has – or has had in the past a positive reviewed sort of position. I don't know if it's that. I mean, we need Jonathan to explain whether it's still like that. But I think mostly they try to say positive rather than negative things, which, you know, is fine. I know that's what Charles liked.
Yep.
So even though he writes a number of positive reviews, yeah, still excellent critic and a highly respected critic. And I wasn't ever going to read Evaporating Genres.
Oh, why not?
Because
you're not a non-fiction reader, are you?
I don't like non-fiction. I'm not a big fan of non-fiction generally. I'd rather read fiction in my spare time. And funny I should say that because, you know.
And this is a special type of non-fiction where it's not like history or something. You know, it's literary criticism.
I mean, it's bullshit when I say I don't like non-fiction, obviously, because I spend half my day reading blogs and surprisingly, they're not non-fiction. And a lot of them are essay length. Plus, as a air quotes critic,
you should maybe be reading some critical theory.
Correct. You'd think I would. So I really enjoyed this.
I did.
And you know why? Because of what you said before, it is quite conversational. So
it is because this is – I mean we should, for people who aren't aware, it's a collection of essays.
Tell us the plot.
Tell us the plot.
It's a bunch of essays.
Once upon a time, there was a critic. No, it's a collection of essays that Gary has previously published in all various locations. So some of them are quite what I would call quite dense academic type essays in terms of their language.
So you say that, but there weren't too many technical terms that I found went over my head.
Well, it's not just jargon. It's the construction of sentences.
I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but I have a master's in philosophy.
I know.
Have I mentioned that? Yeah. Anyway, I had to read a lot of secondary source material.
So that's why much of it didn't go over your head.
No, I'm just saying that you compare this academic work to the stuff that you have to read in philosophical journals, which are all jargon. This is reasonably light on for jargon.
Okay.
You keep looking at me like I'm rambling.
No, I'm just saying that some of the essays reminded me a lot more of academic papers.
Okay.
And some were much more conversational.
Okay.
They're all very interesting essays. They're not – like it's not – it's unified around the theme of discussing aspects of
genre.
Fantastical literature. Yeah. But it's not – doesn't have an overarching kind of argument for the whole book, except possibly that genre is not exactly what we think it is.
Does it not set up a taxonomy of genre?
Okay.
I'm pretty sure the word taxonomy was used a number of times in
But yeah, no, it's good. And the titular essay is the one that it goes into the idea that evaporating genres, Gary's quick to point out in that essay, is not that he's not saying that the genres are like disappearing or vanishing or you know, being left behind necessarily, but that they're just becoming quite pervasive. I think he uses a metaphor that they're just in the air, they're like mist. they're no longer kind of contained, and the tropes of genre and the you know, the structures and all that sort of stuff of genre are sort of dissipating into outside literature and vice versa.
Yes.
And the genres are less containable in terms of, like, definitionally.
Yeah, well, and he does that by going to the history of each of the genres, each fantasy, science fiction, and horror. To show
yeah,
the
they're the three big ones.
And he shows the antecedents of them. And actually, the historical stuff I found the most fascinating.
Yeah.
Even though he's mentioned a lot of it on Coode Street, it still felt new and interesting to me. And there were a bunch of authors he mentioned who I'd never heard of, but I bet you others have. Just knowing how ignorant I am. But I thought but he sets up that framework by looking, well, let's,
yeah.
You don't just jump in and say, well, here's a theory. You go through the historical side and go, well, there's actually the patterns that I'm talking about existed 70, 80 years ago, and here's the antecedents of those patterns.
And then, he's talking about sort of different aspects of genre and different writers within genre. What I did appreciate about this book, which you don't often get in a general speculative fiction book, is, and I know listening from the Coode Street podcast, Gary has quite an interest in the horror genre. And there was a lot of attention paid to horror in this.
Yes,
in this
yes,
volume,
I thought about that
really,
too. Yes,
really good.
More than I, yeah, in fact, there's a whole chapter on Peter Straub.
Yeah, Peter Straub and the new horror. Listening to the Coode Street podcast, he talks about horror quite frequently. He's obviously quite interested in
the
genre.
But he's not a
fan,
though. In particular of horror. He's a fan of Peter Straub and a couple of writers, but I don't think he would say he's an expert in the field. But it was nice that he didn't, because it's common to
It's often glossed over.
Yes, correct. It's to ignore horror.
It's the black sheep, it's the poor cousin, it's the one you kind of sit in the corner and don't talk about or make eye contact with. So it was good to see that genre getting a lot of attention. And the chapter on Peter Straub and the new horror was a really good chapter, because it was talking about
Amelia Beamer.
Yeah, Amelia Beamer. Co-authored.
Yep.
Two of the essays in that book, that one and the one on what they call 21st century stories.
Yep.
And just talking about how the horror genre has evolved and expanded and maybe evaporated. Yeah, no, it was a very good essay. I quite enjoyed that one. A lot of them are really thought-provoking, kind of makes you think about the way we talk about genre, sort of inside and outside genre, as, you know, it's just so artificial, isn't it? It really completely is. And we've talked about this on the podcast before, about how what makes a book genre. And when we did the podcast with Oryx and Craig by Margaret Atwood, we had a discussion about, well, why isn't this science fiction? Why is Margaret Atwood excluded from, you know, which she is, I think, to a lesser extent these days.
She self-excludes herself. Well, she does. She says, I don't write science fiction. So she self-excludes herself.
Well,
but that's a side issue, though, because it's not up to her whether she is or isn't.
Yeah.
It's up to us, the reader. But that's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is. It's a lot of the times it seems to be which environment a particular author has emerged from, as to whether they're considered genre or not. You know, why is Justin Cronin's The Passage not just a horror novel?
Well, it is, though, isn't it?
No, but I mean, in terms of how it's received and how it's looked at, that's because Justin Cronin came from the literary side of things. So in a way, books are often, I guess, tagged genre or otherwise by the status of the author, more than the book itself, it can seem, especially if you consider previous works of an author.
So, okay, like a Cormac McCarthy.
Yeah.
Where he's writing sort of updated Westerns.
Yeah.
And then,
and quite literary books. He uses a lot of, you know, literary tropes.
Yes, and then he writes a book like The Road.
Yeah, which is, you know, a dystopian post-apocalyptic,
but is not treated that
fantasy
way.
Fantasy / science fiction novel.
Yeah. Well, it's a science fiction novel, straight out SF novel. Yes.
That's what I mean. Yeah. So, I mean, the way we...
Because he doesn't play in our shed.
He doesn't play in our shed.
Therefore, he's stealing. What he's done, he's gone and stolen the tropes and is using them. And how dare he do that?
Well, that's an attitude that is out there. Not about Cormac McCarthy necessarily, but, you know, about writers who don't necessarily visibly come from fandom, because you can't make an assumption that an author, just because, you know, they haven't gone to cons and wrote letters of comment to Locus and so on, haven't actually spent their entire life reading science fiction and fantasy. So it is an assumption that's made.
Yeah, I think the other thing is, we talked about it before, you said it was like a mist, how fluid the genres are anyway.
Yeah.
And there actually aren't clear boundaries between the three major genres. We've put names on them.
Yep. And there's that last chapter, penultimate chapter actually, because the last chapter is about John Clute, which is really funny.
Yes.
I really enjoyed that one, which was addressing the idea of a critic who doesn't come from academia.
Yes.
But who's still very serious.
But it was brilliant because who's created his own words, his own terminology.
Yeah, exactly. And you know.
Actually, I want to go back to that. So finish this.
But the penultimate chapter, which was I think it was just called 21st Century Stories. And they're talking about they have this massive list that they start with in the first paragraph. Actually, I'll read it out because it was really funny. So when they're talking about the evolution of the genres being fantasy, horror, science fiction, they're saying that this is, you know, it's given rise to new terms, slipstream, interstitial, transrealism, new weird, non-realist fiction, new wave fabulist, postmodern fantasy, post-genre fiction, cross-genre fiction, span fiction, artists without borders. That's my personal favourite. New humanist, fantastica, liminal fantasy, transcendental horror. And then they acknowledge that, okay, they made that last one up. But but that's the thing, it's like because the genre, or what we can think of as genre fiction possibly, has just expanded so widely and takes from all different genre and non-genre work that's out there. There's almost like, it's not that they're sui generis, but there's new works create all these new subgenres, and are they subgenres or are they just convenient tags we need to try?
Isn't it a case that we're scared that some of this stuff will escape our hold, so we have to put a tag on it just to say it's still with us, it's still here?
Well, it's more that, yeah, but it's also when they're talking about slipstream fiction and so on.
Yeah, but things like slipstream.
But what the argument that Gary Wolfe and Amelia Beamer are making in that essay is that these things are kind of, they're defined more by what they're not than what they are.
Yes, that's
which
true.
Which is a really problematic way of creating a definition. It's not this, therefore it must be this. So you'll have, say, a story or a novel that comes out and you think, well, it's not really science fiction because it doesn't do this and it doesn't have this. So maybe it's this other thing. And it's just...
And we need a word for that.
We need a word for that so we can talk about it. So it's this blossoming of taxonomy, as you're saying,
yes.
of all this subgenre and sub-subgenre, and it's.
I still think there's an element of there are certain, either there are writers in other camps who we want to adopt,
yeah,
who we will we'll call something slipstream, and with that definition of what it's not, we can chuck them in there as well and say,
sure,
hey, they're slipstream, and now they're part of us. For those who want to broaden the church of genre out there.
Yeah, no, sure, definitely. And it's also a way of differentiating yourself from what has come before.
But there's got to be a reason.
So defining yourself as something that's new, something that's breaking new ground, doing something different.
But that's the point.
Yeah.
We had New Wave, we had Cyberpunk.
Yeah.
Since then, all we've had is a lot of terms, and no one's been able to, other than a bit of steampunk, there's really been no movements since Cyberpunk, you could argue.
Sure. But you also have to acknowledge that movements are often only defined retrospectively.
Yeah. Well, I know Cyberpunk was 85, 86, Sterling Gibson.
Yeah, and they kind of defined themselves.
They did. They happened to do that. But
it was very much a creative genre. Actually, that was another interesting thing.
Okay.
I forget which essay it was in now. I did bookmark it, but it was Gary makes the point that science fiction since the 1920s has been very much a creative genre. It created itself. It established its own magazines, which were kind of this self-perpetuating thing where this was where the markets were. So you wrote for those markets, and those markets defined the stories that were written. And then people, science fiction became quite a self-created genre. And perhaps these days that's failing a little. And by failing, I don't mean it's not in a bad way. I mean, because there's such a proliferation of markets and space in which authors can play that they're no longer kind of codified by just having these six magazines that they can submit to, for instance, if they write science fiction. So these six editors who will define what science fiction is.
So they'll send to other short story markets, write a story that could easily fit into FNSF, but they'll send somewhere else. It'll even be published by that other market.
Sure. And also then you have new publishers and new markets springing up to fill gaps. So you'll have a magazine like Clark's World, which is publishing some really, really interesting stories, which, you know, I guarantee you that 50 years ago, very little of what Clark's World published would have been considered science fiction.
Well, yeah, no, fair
point. So you get new markets filling niches. Yeah, this proliferation, which, you know, is largely due to the internet, let's face it, which allows for, I think, a lot of play within genre, a lot of play across and outside of genre. And there's kind of market for that now. We have our economies of scale are shrinking in terms of what's able to be published and brought to light. You no longer have to do a print run of 10,000 books, for example, to have a viable publication. You can do a small press run and do 100 books.
Well,
done.
And they do. Okay. Is it still viable?
Sure. It's not going to make anyone $1 million.
So how does that come back to the proliferation?
What I'm saying is because there are bigger markets out, not bigger markets necessarily, but more markets out there.
Yeah.
You have more editors out there. You have more tastemakers. You have more niches. So people who are writing fiction, they have more space to play.
Okay, so wait a sec. Back in the old days that Gary talks about, there were fewer gatekeepers.
It's not
tastemakers.
Because that's really what it's about, isn't it? If you're writing fiction.
And just a segue to the tip tree, it's clear that in the '70s, in the late '60s, early '70s, you had Frederick Pohl, Ed Furman, Silverberg, Harry Harrison, mostly guys, and, you know, four or five guys who were basically the standard. And if you could get it through them, you got published. If you didn't, because you said before, Clark's World is publishing stuff that 50 years ago wouldn't have seen the light of day. Why wouldn't it seen the light of day? Because if you didn't meet – I mean, the funny thing, the tip tree is that she wrote her novel in present tense and they all went, present tense stories.
It's not – but I think like –
So I've maybe taken your point elsewhere.
That's come from like what Gary's saying is it with a self-created genre. It's not necessarily that people were writing those stories and editors were going, oh no, that's not science fiction, we're not publishing it. People weren't writing them because it's a complicated relationship.
No, I understand. Like it self-perpetuates. I get what you're saying.
Markets and authors and readers kind of support and feed each other.
You think that's what the story that they want, therefore I'm going to write a similar story to that.
Yeah.
You don't think to break the boundaries because you're not seeing – that's why – and again, I'm segueing back.
Yeah.
Because I love this book by Julie Phillips.
This is the tip tree.
Yeah, sorry, Gary.
We should really just talk about them together because they do mesh really well.
But I'm saying sorry, Gary, because, you know, that it's interesting. Yeah. That's what's so important about Alice Sheldon is that she wasn't part of the gang and just wrote this stuff. There's other issues with Alice Sheldon that we discussed, but she wrote these stories that broke the mold, and that's why she was such an eye opener for the. That's what they were so interested. Mm. If she'd written just the same old, it wouldn't be mattered if she called herself James Tiptree or Ian Mond.
Because James Tiptree was writing very interesting work. And work that felt very fresh.
Correct. And it broke the mold and it showed William Gibson said he was inspired by her. I mean, he said that Neuromancer is a direct result of Tiptree.
Yeah.
So that's massive. That's huge. And I understand what you're saying, that people seeing the same thing, just publishing the same thing, it self-perpetuates and just goes in a sort of grind.
Well, it's not necessarily a grind.
But what I'm
saying is one of the things that this book made me think about was – yeah, now that we have such a larger space out there, it does allow a greater variety.
Yeah, that's the positive spin.
It is the positive spin, yeah. And that's it. I mean, that's the good thing about it.
It does make me wonder, though, what was going on in the 50s, 60s and 70s in terms of science fiction. I mean, it's considered the golden age. The 50s especially is considered the golden age. Yet as Gary doesn't really point out, but I'm going to – this is not Gary's argument, but let's just run with it – is that the self-perpetuating markets meant that there was a lot of similarity, which everyone was comfortable with.
But it also meant there was a lot of community. There was a lot of – and there was a lot of authors bouncing off each other and writing stories in response to each other and all that sort of stuff.
But this is where – this goes back to our original point.
And it still
point.
Happens today.
This goes back to our original point. This is where the formation of the genre definitions came in and the boundaries became so solid. That's definitely SF.
Yeah.
That's definitely fantasy. That's definitely horror.
I mean, break it down even further, that's definitely an Asimov story. Yes. That's definitely an astounding story.
Yes.
That's definitely an SF story. I mean, you know, types of stories became definitionally coded to a particular magazine.
Yes, and you're right. I'm so fucking happy that we don't do that anymore. that there isn't that. I mean, there I is a little bit analog still.
I mean,
still,
I think you can still say this is a – you know, you write a story, you go, well –
an analog story,
well,
an analog story
would,
but that's about
would,
it,
would this
really
be a Clarksworldian
no,
type
but
of story?
But no, there isn't.
No, not in terms of like – but would this be a good market to send this story? Because markets still have their guidelines. Markets yes, still have their preferences
I know,
and their taste.
I know that. I know that.
What I'm just saying is there's more markets. There are more markets.
Okay.
And they're filling more niches.
I still think,
and
though,
every time a niche comes up, a market goes, oh, I'll fill that.
I still think, though, the way that Asimov's, especially Clark's World, Lightspeed, these and the other – and FNSF as well, unlike Analog, which is a very, very specific niche.
Yes.
Those others – the stories in them, for the most part, could be interchangeable in the sense of, you know, quality yeah. and themes, etc.
Yeah, possibly.
I can't see any a Clark's World story, other than the fact that the editor may not like it, going, oh, no, we don't publish that sort of stuff today. That's the difference for me. As you said, based on the codification of magazine equals certain story, I don't think the major players today, I don't think, other than Analog, I don't think that's the case. I keep
no,
saying
it
Analog
probably
because
isn't.
It's a clear, still a clear bet.
No, I mean it probably isn't, but you're still gonna you're still gonna fit in with, you know, a particular editor's idea of what
that,
they want to publish.
Yes, but more around a matter of taste than a matter of legacy or history.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
It's now more about taste.
Yeah,
like one of the points. No, this is.
But wasn't it always taste anyway?
Well, I don't know. This is my epiphany. This is my epiphany, Kirsten.
Okay, sorry, epiphany.
Because the feeling I got from the Tiptree as well is that when she wrote her first novel, and it was in present tense, because that really rang a bell. And also, when they just read that bit, it was rejected by a number of publishers, and I got the feeling that, well, people don't like present tense. It wasn't. I might personally like the book, but our public doesn't like present tense.
A lot of people don't like present tense still.
You write in present tense.
I do. That's why I know a lot of people don't like it.
Yeah. I wonder whether it was just sort of, well, these are the rules of science fiction. These are the rules of these magazines, and this is how it works, and you just don't buck those trends. You can play your old little. You can do a few things here and there, but basically, you don't buck the trends that we've set up. Whereas today, you can buck the trends a lot more. You still probably wouldn't be able to sell that story to Analog. I mean, I've mentioned Analog about 18 times
poor
in the last 3 minutes. I'm not against Analog. I still think they've got a clear market.
Yeah,
very clear market,
which is
hard SF for the most part,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, sort of going back to the Campbell Golden vision of the superhero man who uses technology to save the day, there's still that genuine thread going through Analog.
Okay.
Not every story, but that sort of aftertaste is still there. Whereas with the other markets, you don't feel that if I wrote a completely off-the-wall, weird, wacky story,
mm-hmm.
you feel that one of those, as long as it was well written, whatever that means, subject to that, yep. You know, in context
yep.
of that story.
Sure.
One of the markets were taken on. They wouldn't look through their rule book and go, "Oh, well, actually, it starts sentence with and." Sometimes I get the feeling when you read
that
both
that's
Gary's
what it was
book.
Like.
No, reading Gary's book and reading the Phillips, that there was that sense of codification to how things are meant to be. And you're right; it's a self science fiction, especially as you said, as Gary says, a self created genre. Therefore, creates its own rules. Therefore, the moment the other breaks through, tries to break those rules, it's on for young and old. And that's what's caused the flame wars back in the 50s and 60s.
Sure, absolutely.
Sorry, that was my rant.
That was your rant.
Yeah.
No, I think there's fairness in that rant. I'll pay that.
It's not often you pay one of my rants.
But I think, I mean, people do have rules about stuff. I mean, present tense is actually a big one. I'm not entirely sure why. My story, Painlessness.
Yes.
It was actually rejected by someone purely because it was written in present tense.
It's a corker, though.
Yeah. And they said they really liked the story. They just didn't like present tense. And would I rewrite it in past tense? And I said, no.
But you
write
in present tense without getting into the mechanics of writing. Present tense is about the active voice. It really allows for a much easier use of the active voice.
There are different reasons to use it. I don't always write. I've written stories. I've got one coming out next year, actually. Two coming out next year, both in past tense. So it depends on the type of story you're telling and why you're telling it. I think you're definitely making a choice, and I think you need to back that choice up. And, of course, you need to write it well. But, I mean, there are some people who, you know, there are some people who go, well, I'm not going to publish anything that has italics and thoughts.
I'm not saying it doesn't exist today. The code's the codes are still there.
There are editors who have
down.
Personal
yes,
bugbears about
a lot
what
– more watered down, in my view, than they were back then. Yeah, without having lived back then as Gary
probably.
But I do want to, talking about that, I do want to talk about the Clued essay because it's the last one. And
yes.
It's beauty.
That was a great
essay. And it's a bit of a love letter from Gary, a bit of man love letter from Gary on Mr. Clued. But just because Jonathan McElmont wrote an essay on his blog, Ruthless Culture, which you'll have to link to now that I've mentioned it, so
okay.
You'll have to find it, about science fiction. And in a sense, and basically what he's saying is that there isn't a, unlike film theory and other art theory, et cetera, there isn't a terminology within genre or a set of critical terms that we use to discuss SF novels in a critical sense. And there's a bit of a death, and therefore what we do in the end is we fall back on, well, and he picked Heinlein as his example. We fall back on, well, Heinlein was good because he was able to do this, this, and this without being able to explore it in greater depth because mm-hmm. those people become essentially sacred cows. But also, there seems to be an incapability of breaking those things apart using these critical.
Sure.
Terms,
that, so there's no lexicon for critical
yes.
theory at a genre level.
And I was reading his essay on the web at the same time I was reading. The Wolf essay on Clute, because Clute's all about
totally,
a lexicon.
Totally making up words all the time.
It's all just made up words. Portmanteaus?
Of course.
Portmanteaus, is that what we call them? Portmanteaus?
Oh, no, some of them are just made up words all the time. He's not always putting words together. He's just making
them up.
Portmanteaus
putting them together.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which he's probably done, but I mean, most of the time he's.
Yeah, they're just. But they're pulled out of his ass. Yeah.
Well, probably out of his brain.
Yes, he's making up words.
Yeah.
And
he's making them up, but he's also often picking up words that have, you know, entered the popular discourse, like big dumb object, for example, or something like that. So he'll put that in the encyclopedia. It's not necessarily something he's made up, but it's something that it's entered the discourse when you start talking about books. It's another big dumb object book. It's, you know, it's another story in a can book. This book has a lot of it he has made up, but he's also collecting and cataloguing terms that have come from, amateur criticism.
Yeah, and I just wanted Jonathan to understand.
Jonathan?
McElmont to understand.
Oh, right, okay, yep.
That there is, even though I'm not a big fan of Clute's reviews, I actually find them to be a tad too pretentious for me and sometimes unreadable, possibly because of the made-up words.
Okay,
but,
moving on.
Yes, no, but even so, there are critics out there who aren't just falling back on what's been said a million times before, but are trying to create a language out there within SF criticism. And I think Gary also has a crack at it.
Yeah.
Not necessarily in terms of terms, but in the way that he defines certain subgenres, like post-apocalyptic or other subgenres
yeah.
that are interesting, or, you know, things like the big dumb object stuff and that,
yeah.
which he does in this book and does, I think, quite well.
You know, there's a long, deep history of literary theory. It may not have some very specific terms applied to genre because some of these genres are quite recent. But, I mean, in terms of overall literary critical theory, I mean, you've got a structure and a lexicon and a taxonomy to work with.
Yes. And moving on.
Okay, we're moving on. Oh, God. That's a brutal segue.
I know. No, actually, we're not moving on because, as you said, we've been mashing these books together and we'll probably come back to it.
Yeah.
I do want to say that it is evaporating genres, even though I would never have read it if not for this podcast. Sorry, Gary. It's great. I'm actually quite annoyed with myself that I even have these prejudices because it is a really, really.
I bet you're expecting to be a lot denser.
Yeah, I was.
And a lot more.
Yeah, it was Hugo nominated, let's be fair.
Yeah. It's a really accessible, yes. conversational in a lot of parts.
Yeah, if you like Gary's Locust reviews, it's
absolutely.
Very similar. With all these, and funny too.
And funny, yeah, there are jokes.
There are jokes in there.
And little asides.
Yeah, a couple of little asides, yes. Yeah, I wish the footnotes were at the bottom though, rather than having to flick at the end.
What, the end notes?
Yeah, I don't like end notes. Okay. Now, Julie Phillips wrote.
Most of them, to be fair, are just the bibliographic references.
Yes, that's why I'd stop looking at them.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So, yes, Julie Phillips.
Yes, the book I recommended.
The book you recommended was Julie Phillips' biography of James Tiptree Jr. : The Double Life of Alice B. Sheldon.
It was such a good book.
I enjoyed
this book so much.
This is an astonishing piece of writing for a variety of reasons. You know what was funny for me?
What?
It's about the headline's James Tiptree Jr.
Yeah.
But we actually don't get to the life of Mr. Tip.
Yeah.
Until about page 215.
It's just, and you know what? Around the halfway point.
And I could see I've just imagined this sort of SF fan who's reading it because I want to know about Tiptree the writer. Going, fuck, can we get it past Africa already? And all this other shit. I don't care about it. I want to get straight to the SF stuff. But actually, in reality, what Julie's done is a fantastic job because
it builds up. It's a biography of Alice Sheldon,
who
happened to spend some years of her life writing as James Tiptree.
But she's smart. There's foreshadowing, there's quotes from the Tiptree period, the feedback to her early childhood and all that sort of stuff. So, you know, it's a holistic book. It's not just bits and pieces, set pieces of her life.
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful biography.
And told in a really interesting narrative. It's not creative nonfiction. It's not like characters
it's
in it talking. It's a biography.
Yeah. And it's a really good – I mean, she's obviously had a wealth of research material made available to her.
It's all in the back. She says exactly where she got some pieces from.
And she's spent years researching and writing this book.
I actually – because you know it. You know she's read every novel written by Mary Bradley, Alice Sheldon's mother. Who was a crime?
She probably has.
And also the novel written by Alice Sheldon's first husband.
Yes,
because she quotes that extensively. Yes. You're thinking, wow, this stuff
She has done her research.
Yeah,
she has immersed herself in Alice Sheldon's world.
Took 10 years or so
world.
To write this.
Something like that. Yeah. And it's a fantastic biography. It's a sympathetic biography without being too sentimental.
It's not, though. No, you're right.
That's what I mean. Like, it's a very sympathetic biography. She's obviously on Alice's side.
Yeah.
But it's not sentimental. It doesn't gloss over the rough bits. And you know, at many times it's quite sort of very critical of some of Alice's choices and things that she did. So it's sympathetic without being sentimental. I think that's the best phrase for it. And it's really just beautifully written. It's a book that is very much about its subject matter and not the writer. Because some biographies can get a bit, look how clever I am as the biographer, but this is a book about Alice
Julie
Sheldon,
doesn't turn up
wonderful.
And start waving at you at all times and say, see?
No, it's
all about Ali.
Yeah, it's a really, really fantastic book and I enjoyed it so much.
What does it say, though? You know,
what does it say? Biography.
No, yeah, no. Say ... about mental health. I don't know. I found it really upsetting at times because this is – it's funny. One of the points that Phillips makes and actually Ali to some extent makes, and I call her Ali because that's what she
–
that's the name she likes.
Actually, that was a really – like the
Alice versus Ali, the way she transitioned.
The way the names were changed through and the gender. So when she was talking – when the biographer was talking about Tiptree – the pronouns would be he and him and his.
Yes.
And she changed the name. She referred to Alice Sheldon sometimes as Alice and then as Ali as
well,
that nickname.
Once Tim's mother coined her Ali, it becomes Ali for the rest of the book.
It was a really nice, subtle way of grounding the changes of this woman's life.
Yes, absolutely. And the interesting thing is that this is not someone who had a terrible childhood.
No, she had a great
awesome
childhood.
Look, I don't want to particularly taking Joshy to Africa on safari, but back in the 1915s, it was something. Not
all of them, all the 1915s.
All the 1915s, back in them days. You could take your 6-year-old or a bit older to safari out to shoot gorillas.
Because their parents were anthropologists.
They were,
Sorry,
the word's explorers, okay?
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, back then, sure.
Yes. Well,
big game hunters sometimes.
Game hunters. But with ecological stuff in mind, they weren't out there to just kill gorillas.
Yeah, and Alice's mother was writing articles and so on about the travels
and
books.
They're both from a very privileged background.
Oh, they were
very
wealthy people.
Yes. And, you know, were very – Chicago –
Well, you had to be to kind of self-fund your own safari to Africa.
Yes.
So.
Chicago socialites had an African room where they hung up everything. I mean, look, it does –
sounds hideous.
It does. And from a colonial, post-colonial point of view.
I just had visions of this room with the animal skins everywhere and the heads on the walls. And like, oh.
Possibly the odd dead gorilla. But from a post-colonial point of view, there's a sort of uneasiness to it.
Yeah, there is.
Because, you know, it's the...
And I think that comes through in the writing
Yeah, it
as
does.
Well.
It does. The poaching. And actually, the thing that Philip says is you can draw that line to the fiction of Tiptree about dealing with the other, dealing with alien, you know, as going back to her time in Africa. But even though I might have felt and you might have felt uneasy about the colonial nature of it, you know, poaching from other cultures and in a sense treating them a little bit like toys.
And then it was also like the bit where, because they made several trips back to Africa, and like every time they go, it's like, oh, it's getting a bit too civilized.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
yeah,
we'd like to keep you know, the way you were.
Right. Yeah. and how dare those Mau Maus
to come and have a holiday?
How dare those Mau Maus revolt in Kenya and things like that?
Yes,
but anyway,
yes.
but yeah, even though there is that element, it's still an amazing childhood, and that's so you can't draw that line and say, well, she is the way she is. That's the thing. She had a great childhood, but didn't necessarily have the connection with her mother and father.
Well, I think she had a very strong connection with her mother,
but not
whether or not it was entirely healthy.
Yes, that's it. It's and there was a jealousy there, especially with the mother at times.
Definitely got the impression that. Yeah, both ways. Like yes. The mother was sort of using Alice to
– Mary, we should call it.
Yeah, Mary was using Alice to, in some ways, be Mary 2.0.
Yes.
and Alice could never quite
– Because Mary couldn't have any more kids.
Yeah.
And Mary was long-lived.
She did. She
– So she died at 94.
Yeah.
And that was terrible, you should say this, but that was a problem. No, but that was a problem for Alice, because not only did she keep going having to see her mother in the last few years, yes,
and Mary was quite ill, so it was a lot of stress for Alice.
But it meant more that through her life, Mary
is always there.
That's right. It's not like she carked when she was in the 50s and Alice could move on. She was always kick the bucket. What do you say?
So nice.
Carked it. That's what we say in Australia.
She was always there. She was always in Alice's life.
Yeah, and look, Mary's not an evil character in this.
No.
In any way. The amount that Alice Sheldon gets away with in her youthful time, her first marriage is basically just marrying the guy after meeting him once.
Yeah, they kind of elope.
They elope.
Yep.
and she's privileged.
Yep.
In the gossip mags.
Yep.
This is a major
she's
piece
a socialite.
Of gossip. Socialite. But Mary doesn't turn around and say, you're disowned. And Herbert doesn't turn around and say,
no,
you're disowned, you're out of the family. They do everything they can to support them.
It was a very loving, supportive family. I mean, there were quirks, but this wasn't an abusive family. This wasn't a family who was fraught with you know, drama and, you know, all of that. I think there are a lot of interpersonal issues, as you get with most families, but it wasn't an awful.
It just feels like, for whatever reason, chemical or otherwise, the quirks of those relationships grew bigger and bigger in Alice's head as she herself couldn't find a place for herself.
Yeah, I think that was the thing. That's what came across. Like she just couldn't find. And even when she created Tiptree, almost it seems on a whim.
Yes.
And Tiptree found a place. But he was almost displacing her.
Yes.
It really was he was this separate person. And when it all came out and it was revealed that Tiptree was actually Alice Sheldon, how much of what happened was from her own perception? Because it's hard to tell in this book. I think the biographer does a really good job of presenting what Alice thought about things, and that people were then rejecting her and you know, not valuing her enough and critiquing her work differently because they'd found out she was a woman. And that's...
But Julie says that's not true.
Yeah, the biographer will then quote another letter from someone. But whatever the actual situation was, certainly in Alice's Sheldon's head, it was Tiptree who overshadowed everything. And once Tiptree was gone, she couldn't just step into his place.
But she did
because
still
she
write,
wasn't
though. That
Tiptree.
Didn't, her writing didn't end there.
No, it didn't. But I don't think she... It didn't seem like she ever felt that she was as accepted for herself as Tiptree had been.
Yeah.
Which quite conceivably might have been the case in some circles, because it's an odd thing, isn't it?
You know what I think it was? It feels, reading it, I felt that she thought she would be kicked out of the club.
And she wasn't.
And
so she
wasn't.
Was kind of waiting to be.
Yeah. And she wasn't.
And never did. So
I want to quote, if I can find it, Silverberg's response – to finding out because he'd written the introduction, that first introduction to the first collection, where he absolutely and utterly says Tiptree is a man.
It's totally masculine writing.
Totally
it's
masculine
awesome.
Writing.
A woman couldn't write this way.
And Phillips does a beautiful job of just putting in one small paragraph Silverberg's reaction to the truth. Silverberg said he didn't mind about defending Tiptree's masculinity. I suppose I'll eat some crow over that, but I'm not at all annoyed with you, he wrote. You didn't fool me, I fooled myself, and so be it. He confessed that he felt intimidated by guns, fishing rods, politics and tent poles, and had been taken in by Tiptree's competence in these matters. Tip had seemed the better man.
I know, isn't that beautiful?
It is, it's just, yeah.
It is, it's beautiful. It just shows the assumptions people will make. Yeah, I loved a lot of that crossover between what people – because you know when you're reading the biography and then you read what other people are saying about Tiptree and it's some of it's so delicious.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that response from Silverberg is just fantastic.
Yeah, that's it.
Just fantastic. And there's not a lot of people, I'd hazard, who would be that gracious.
No, that's right. She's genuinely thinking they're all going to shit on me for this.
Yeah. I know she was – because she had a very strong – relationship via letters with Joanna Russ and Ursula yes. Le Guin, and it did seem that she was terrified that she would lose those relationships.
And Le Guin
with those
said
women.
It's the best Christmas present I've ever had.
Yeah,
it genuinely shocked me.
Yeah, like and Russ was okay with it too.
Yeah.
The
Russ relationship, that is fascinating.
I want to read a Joanna Russ biography now, of the same quality and depth and
go on and do it.
And intimacy is oh yes, please, Julie. I'm sure you've got another 10 years to spend researching Joanna Russ.
I'll tell you something. I would love if it would work, but it wouldn't. You'd love to make a film of those two.
Oh.
Just that toing and froing.
Yeah, I'd actually love what I'd actually forget the Joanna Russ bio. I'm sure I'm hoping there's one out there. There might not be. I would love to see the published letters. God, I'd love that. I would love to read the correspondence between Tiptree and Joanna.
And Le Guin.
And Le Guin.
The three of those.
I'd love. And, Harlan Ellison and Barry Maltzberg, a whole bunch of other people too. But I think the letters between Joanna Russ and James Tiptree and Ursula Le Guin and James Tiptree. And then the letters from Alice Sheldon. Yeah, I'd love to read those letters. That would be
awesome.
Maybe
Julie can photocopy them for you and send them over.
I'm sure she's had to send all that research material back.
I'm certain she's listening as well to this podcast.
That would be a wonderful book because it sounded like from what she quoted in them, it wasn't just personal letters between them. There was a lot of discourse about the field and about writing.
They hated each other for 6 months, or at least they stopped communicating.
But you know what I mean? It wasn't just, letters, hi, how are you? Here's what's going on in my life. There was that, which would be interesting enough, but there seems to be a lot of critical discourse about the field and about their work and each other's work and other people's work and all of this stuff, which I think it'd be a fascinating book. I'm not sure who has the rights to all those. I mean, Ursula Le Guin obviously still has the rights to her own correspondence. But yeah, I don't know if it'd be practical to try and gather all those together, but, it'd be a fabulous book.
And
book.
You've got.
I'm putting that wish out to the universe. I want a Russ Tiptree/Sheldon Le Guin collected letters, please.
Can I latch onto that wish and push it
go
further?
For it? Go for it. Turbocharge the wish.
Yeah, I also found interesting that there's this idea that Alice was bisexual. Well, not an idea. She was bisexual.
Yeah.
But never entirely accepted it in her life.
Yeah. Well, never – didn't seem to really entirely accept
her attraction to women. Yeah.
A little bit early on perhaps, but I think after a couple of possible rejections she kind of maybe shelved. She just seemed to have this really complex and fraught relationship with the idea of other women and being a woman and female friendship and all of that. And it's just so interesting. Like all of that existed before Tiptree and throughout Tiptree and after Tiptree.
It's her love and hatred.
So it wasn't as though she became Tiptree and that complicated female relationships because she was writing. All of that was before. That was all there, groundwork.
Absolutely. that paradox of hating women for not standing up for themselves, for not making a louder noise and allowing the power to be held by men, but also her love for women.
Yeah. And I mean, this just like this echoes and ripples today. You read exactly the same things today, don't you?
I'm reading the
same story, different page.
I know. It's shocking, actually. And actually made me a bit angry. You're reading the discussions that Russ and Tiptree are having in 75, and you think, shit, they're the fucking same discussions we're having now.
Yep.
Now, I know in 75 was probably second wave feminism and moving on to third. I know things have, you know, we'd gone first, now second.
It's the same conversation.
But essentially it's the same shit, different day. It really is. And the reactions from the men as well in terms of the feminist movement within SF in the 70s hasn't changed that much either. There are probably a few more allies, I put in quote marks.
I know.
But they're still dickheads.
It's really, in a way, it's really sad. To read something which was written in 1972 and think, well, I could have read that on the internet yesterday.
Yes.
It's like verbatim.
And I know there have been a number of people have pointed this out, but just to read, because I'll say this, I've never read any Russ or Tiptree, which I know is terrible.
If you don't read anything else by Russ, you should read When It Changed.
I have.
That's
the one story I've read.
It's remarkable.
Okay. Yes, and it is fantastic.
It's a really, not only is it a really good story, it's remarkable in that it feels so fresh and like it feels like it could be written this week, you know.
Yes.
It's just because I know and it's sometimes an incorrect perception, but I often feel when you go back and read a lot of the science fiction written in the 50s through to the 70s, there is a type of a language, a type of flow to the words, and it's not always the case, but often they do feel like they're of their time.
Yeah.
And this story was like, wow, it's the most beautiful.
Yeah, I agree.
Wonderfully written story.
And very short.
It's very clean. It feels very new and fresh. And again,
have you read any Tiptree though?
Sadly, of course, meaning like things have not changed.
Yes. No, they haven't. But have you read any Tiptree? I mean, and I asked that.
No.
Yeah, you haven't.
No,
I haven't. So here's the thing. Other than
I really want to now that I was making a list. I was making a list of
other than being the Tiptree
some
award,
of the stories I wanted to track down.
Sorry. Other than being the Tiptree Award, who's reading James Tiptree today?
I don't know. I hope a lot more people post this biography.
But are they though?
I don't know.
I mean, how many people read the biography? There is that question. I mean, that's again, it upset me because the mother, Mary, is constantly saying, "You will leave a legacy. You will make a mark." And there's no doubt that Alice Sheldon made a mark on science fiction.
Absolutely.
Absolutely no doubt, no argument, no one would argue, will never be forgotten. Tiptree name will always be remembered via awards and other things.
Yep.
But will anyone actually be reading the words? That's because to me
that is the same.
That really is the deal here. Because, I mean, yes, you can name 100 awards after Tiptree, but who cares? If no, seriously.
If people aren't reading the words.
If people aren't reading the words, if you're not keeping the fiction alive.
Well, I mean, this is also a problem with writers who are primarily short story writers because it's hard to keep short stories.
Do you think Harlan Ellison's going to go out of print like that?
Some of his works are out of print.
Yeah, some are, but
I don't know.
I can't imagine Ellison just vanishing.
Maybe not, but he was extremely prolific in his short story. Yeah. Like he has dozens of books out, right? If you listen to the Coot Street podcast, I know Jonathan Strahan doesn't think Harlan Ellison's holding up all that well.
Oh, okay.
So who knows? But as you say, Ellison's still very much alive and kicking.
He is.
So
he keeps saying he's about to die. But I still think that there are too many stories of his that are well known in the mainstream.
In the mainstream? Really?
Well,
like outside science fiction?
Okay, maybe not outside of science fiction.
Yeah, no.
No, okay. Mate, look, time will tell.
I may be wrong.
No, you're right. Time will tell. But I think hey, I'm to blame as well. I haven't read any Tiptree. I will after this, though.
Yeah, no, I made a list.
Even if you did spoil all the stories, Julie.
But that is the thing. No, I've not. If I've read a Tiptree, it's been in, you know, probably one of my mum's old science fiction collections when I was a teenager, and I completely don't know that I read a Tiptree. I certainly have not read any in recent years knowingly. So. Yeah, I mean, and that is sad, but I'm really glad I got this bio. And
what, can we go back to gender?
Okay, sure.
Well, because you sounded like you were about to stop.
No, I wasn't. I was just saying I'm really glad I got this bio because that is now going to make me go out and read more Tiptree and more Joanna Russ too, by the way, because there was a lot of Russ in
this book as well. I want, you know who I also remember reading? Le Guin. This is terrible.
Oh no!
I've read a couple of Le Guin short stories, but none of the novels.
Not even the Earthsea when you were.
I've not read any Earthsea. Ori Shifrin has laughed at me a number of times about not having read any Earthsea.
Okay,
it shows the lack of education I've had in terms of certain major.
Not everyone can read all the books. Not everyone can even read most of the books.
No, but to be fair, I was reading a lot of Terence Dick's novelizations.
Well, Doctor Who.
So you know that's what I was doing while people were reading Tiptree, but and Earthsea. But just going back to the gender, I found that debate between Russ and Tiptree about what I felt Tiptree was coming from a gender essentialist sort of point of view. I know you disagree with me, but there seemed to be a strong biological push to her feminism.
I think what was really
and Russ seemed to be attacking that.
Yeah, I think what was really fascinating about Tiptree was, I mean, and the bio was really good at teasing out like how she developed her thoughts and opinions and ideas about this stuff. And it seemed like eventually she ended up in this place where she's talking about there being two sexes and they are man and mother.
Yeah.
But those sexes don't have to be linked to gender. It was weird. It's like she's allocating all these.
Well, I think Russ read her as linking men to the gender.
Yeah, she did. And she did at first, I think. Like she was quite gender essentialist in terms of what women do and what. And she didn't feel that she was a real woman, quote unquote, because she didn't fit this box that she had designed for what women were and what she had perceived other women as being.
Okay.
And she kind of, like, I think from interrogation with Russ, she came around. So I think she stuck to her idea that there are kind of two sexes, and that is this sex called man and this sex called mother. And I guess you can extrapolate from that what the characteristics and features of those were. But they didn't necessarily have to be
essentialist.
Gendered.
Yeah.
It's just this idea of, I mean, and again, I think you'd have to go back and look at her letters in full and her writing and her diaries and, oh, God, I'd love to see her diaries.
But I find that counterintuitive because it's a biological argument. Because she makes it, she says she explicitly does. It's biological.
Yeah. But I think in the beginning, I think Russ kind of
takes
talked
that
around a little around, okay. around that. It's just fascinating to watch the development of her thoughts.
Also, the what seems to come this pessimism
because she really
gets worse and worse about her saying to Russ as well, hold it back, hold that shrill, in a sense, your shrillness back, keep it in, stop getting upset about it all. But also, you will never have the power. Men will always have the power.
Yeah.
Chuck it in. Yes. That's what it felt like.
Yeah, yeah, when she was older and yeah, I think she got tired. You get tired. You get really, really tired.
You just can't fight the fight anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that 37 years later we're still having the same discussions.
Yeah, it's exhausting. But no, I think she's a fascinating person and this autobiography is just great. It really she quotes extensively from Sheldon's letters and her diaries. So you get this mix of public persona and private persona, which I still think was a persona. I think I don't know that it's almost like she has all these layers of who she was and who she wanted to be and who she didn't want to be. And she was sort of crafting. I mean, we all craft our own self. We, you know, there's no such thing as some essential self that we are. We all create our.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who we are. And she just seemed to be doing it perhaps a lot more explicitly and consciously. I mean, she certainly was with Tiptree. That was beautiful, the way she created Tiptree, made him more masculine and would throw in lines, which are obviously deliberate tags to convince the people she was writing
but
to
was
that
never
he
deceptive,
was a man.
She says. Never deceptive because
she never came out and said, I'm a man, did she? Never did. Just talked about hunting and fishing and being horny and liking the women. And they all assumed, so she's a man.
Well, what pronoun? Well, she probably didn't need to use a pronoun, did she? No, because I think Phillips does say that she uses we in one, in, you know, the symposium that in the symposium they did in that fanzine. She does refer to we when talking about men and right, you yeah. when talking about women. So there yeah. was she did gender it a bit.
Yeah, but she's not like she wasn't really lying about the stuff she did.
No, no, because everything she said was true.
Yeah, it just and happened
to be.
In fact,
the history
be,
of Tiptree
yeah,
was her history. That's more right, or less.
More or less.
In fact, that's the irony.
Even
with,
the
yeah, with Racuna Sheldon, she had a little history to throw yeah. at you to make that she actually did.
Yeah,
people.
Because she'd spent it all on Tiptree.
Yeah, so you know, I'm a teacher, real. You know, a housewife. Yeah. That
which is so
made
funny
up.
Because this is the thing, and people are taking from these letters this reinforcement that of course. Tiptree's a man because all of this stuff. But all of that stuff was true. It was just about Alice.
Yeah, I love all that stuff early on about the gun, how she wasn't allowed to shoot a gun. And
yeah.
She cracked the shits when they did give her a gun. They wouldn't let her shoot. Yeah.
Yeah.
And she drew little pictures of herself holding a gun. Yeah.
I mean, she let people believe that she was a CIA agent and stuff like that, but she never said it. They just kind of drew conclusions from.
Yes.
But she knew what she was doing.
Well,
I mean, it's.
Well,
it's,
no, what she did was she superimposed Ting's life into hers.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He wasn't.
Well, she
agent.
Worked for
two, three yeah. years, but he was still there for yeah, 15 years.
Yeah. So, you know, she let things drop that allowed people to draw conclusions, and she never disabused them of that.
But the depression she talks about, especially later on, is all real.
It's, oh, absolutely.
This is a person who was in a dark cloud.
Yeah.
And of the bit where she. Her journal because she kept a log of all the drugs she took.
Yes.
In a 2-week period, she was taking everything.
Yeah.
From barbiturates to
speed. It's a massive mix of. I mean.
And codeine and, the whole lot. The whole chem.
Yeah.
She could walk in a pharmacy just buy the whole place.
Well.
And that was to keep, and that was to keep her in the world.
I guess so.
Because she kept drifting.
Yeah. And there's so much of her life that's like really sad. But. She had obviously a lot of joy in her life, a lot of love in her life.
I've got to say though, her reaction to winning a Hugo in Denver is not what you'd expect. You know, you take today, someone wins one, you know, they get thanked, they're on about it. She
was terrified.
She was actually physically sick
yes.
at winning both those awards.
Yeah.
Could you imagine her today with Cheryl doing a Hugo live or whatever on tweets and that? Puking on Twitter,
because I think it did exhaust her too. I definitely got that impression that as much as she, Tiptree was her lifeline and the letters, like her communication with other people and her stories, all of that would. But I think it was quite exhausting as well to be Tiptree and not to be Alice.
The one thing, the other thing I want to talk about is Ting, her love affair with Ting, Ting is her husband.
Yes.
And he was 12 years older than her.
Yeah.
He was, I think, she was 30, he was 42, something like that. She didn't really think much of him, but allowed him to court her.
Yeah.
Their sex was terrible. And as a result, she becomes asexual. Well, although she does say she masturbates, that's about all she does because the sex is terrible. They nearly break up or leave each other.
I think more than once.
More than once. Yep. And they don't have a lot in common either, and yet somehow from all that mess.
Yeah, there's this genuine love.
Yes.
And in the end, a platonic love, but a genuine, genuine love.
To the point that
the
she cannot live without him.
Yeah.
And that's why it ends the way it does.
Yeah, we're going to give spoilers.
Well, you can just look up Wikipedia. I mean, a lot of people.
It's history, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's it. There's this relationship between them. That's a genuine relationship. It's not a relationship of convenience at all.
No.
There's this genuine, loving, caring, supportive relationship between the two of them.
You know what broke me up? The bit where Philip says that she was in such a dark place that he couldn't do anything for her. He would cry.
Yeah. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not a depiction of a tired marriage where the couple have just grown apart and they're just continuing to cohabitate until they die.
sorry, before I die.
I'm counting the days. Just saying.
That's not about me and Jules. That's about you and Jason. I just want to make that clear to my wife if she ever listens to this.
But I mean, it's not that, right? It's not that at all. And it's not a marriage of convenience. She's not staying with him because she can't afford to leave, and vice versa. I mean, it's and they're not having an affair, like affairs.
There was an open marriage for a period.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just they've just settled into this marriage,
and not like a rut.
No, and you know, and it just happens to be a marriage that doesn't involve a sexual aspect. By the end of it.
Yeah.
And significantly before
there
the
was an open period there.
Yeah.
Although he never had – I don't get the feeling that he never slept around. It was more her.
She didn't say a lot about Ting, but so Alice had a bit of exploration to do.
But then sort of said her.
Came back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she could not live without him.
No, no. I think, like, he was her best friend. He supported her and she supported him. I mean, yeah. There was this – I mean, that's the thing. It was this reciprocal thing. It wasn't as though he was the one doing all the supporting and taking care of her. And, you know, it went back and forth and they supported each other in different ways because he also suffered from depression from time to time, although how much of that was situational, I don't know. I got the impression it was possibly more situational with Ting as his health declined and, you know, he was losing his vision and his mobility and stuff. But yeah, it was a really beautiful relationship that just didn't include sex.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose her final act, you could argue, was still a selfish act because she shoots him and then shoots herself.
Yeah, and because they did have a pact of some sort that they would go out together as a double suicide, and whether that is exactly what happened, like, no one's ever going to know.
I say selfish, but you know that if he had died naturally, she wouldn't have been long for this world anyway, because she wouldn't have been able to cope. That's quite clear. That
it was like she just kind of picked. She just said, "This is it. This is the time."
Yeah,
to
but
go.
And I don't mean we've cope. She wouldn't have been able to do her clothes or wash or eat or whatever or live. She could have lived. She just she'd lost.
All
her motivation. All her animus would have gone.
Yeah, like she kind of just picked a time and said, "That's it. We've done what we have to do. We're going now."
Yeah.
I mean, it
she caught
sad.
A death, though. She caught a death from a young age.
Yeah.
Well, the 38 revolver, that's that Brechtian gun on the wall.
Kind of kept it there the whole time,
well,
isn't it? Yeah.
And Phillips does a fantastic job by referring to it constantly. It's that gun on the wall that is going to be.
Yeah. But it's not this tragic book.
Yeah. It's not.
You know, there's a lot of joy and a lot of love and a lot of camaraderie and success in her life as well. It's not this.
She had 30 odd years of essentially a fantastic marriage.
Yeah.
In spite of everything that went.
And she had a lot of very meaningful, very genuine relationships with other writers.
And people that loved her and she loved them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think we should all read this book.
No, should we?
No. Yes, should. You know, I know people don't like saying should, but I think there are certain books that are life-affirming, and in spite of how this one ends.
yeah, okay.
There is something – there is. Life-affirming in the sense of the love we have with our partners or whatever, however we look at it, or just even forget partners, our friends. And you know what the thing that I took out of this, apart from that?
What did you take out of it?
The beautiful thing that she did, every time she read something she loved, she'd write a letter to the author.
Yeah.
Now, who does that?
Well –
other, you know what people do? They go on Amazon, Goodreads, they'll tweet it.
Well, but these days you're not meant to do that, are you? Or, no, sorry, authors aren't meant to respond back. That was the other thing. They reply back to her and friendship started.
Yeah.
These days you're not meant to reply back.
Why not?
I'm going
to start doing it. If I read a book I love, in fact, I'm going to start it with Julie Phillips. I'm dead set. I'm going, awesome. I don't know what her email is.
You should send Gary one too. He'll feel left
out. Less with Gary. But no, you're right. I'll send them both. I actually do believe that is the most beautiful thing. Send some happiness to someone.
It's very nice to get a letter from someone you don't know who says, "I read this thing you wrote and I really liked it. Thank you."
I have no idea how to contact Julie Phillips. Her email might be about somewhere.
I'm sure you could Google her. Or at very worst case, I'm sure you could write to the publisher and they would forward it.
Yeah, I'm not going to go to that much effort.
Oh.
But
it's not three clicks away. Forget it.
Hey, what sort of effort would Alice Sheldon have to have gone to? I mean, she had the...
She carted her typewriter around with her.
Yeah, no, that's true.
For goodness sake, that woman. She had... What was in her roof fell down in her study at one point.
I know.
Yes, and they had a chicken farm.
Yeah, there's a whole section on the chicken farm which we haven't discussed. Not that interesting, but they still had a chicken farm. You know, I think we need to go back to that epistolary way. I think it is beautiful.
Writing letters.
Yeah, writing
letters. Handwriting letters.
Not that. No, not email's that. Fine. Not,
email's fine. Okay.
Julie, if I can get your email address, that'd be great because I will send you personal email.
I'm sure you can Google her.
I will. So I highly recommend this book, and it was refreshing after the last two podcasts to have two books that we love.
And here's the thing, obviously, because neither Ian or I have read Tiptree, much to our great shame and imminent rectification, didn't matter for this book. It's not like there were parts where we're lost or glazing over.
As if you're not in on the joke.
It's this just this wonderful biography of this person. And if anything, it just makes you want to go out and read the stuff. But, yeah, you certainly don't need to know a lot about Tiptree or any of the people in the book.
Yeah, it's not written for an
audience. The biographer does this great job of filling in gaps and explaining to you and quoting sections that need to be quoted. And, it's a really astonishing achievement. And it's just so nice to read too. It's got this lovely voice throughout the whole book.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is what she does with flowing through the different names for Alice, treating Tiptree almost like a separate person.
Yeah.
It's just beautifully written. Really, really nicely done.
And little cliffhanger chapter endings every so often.
Yeah, which,
never happy ones, and then her mother died. And you go, well, that's sad.
And that's the thing. So if you don't know, they are genuine little oh.
The way she ties it together. So highly recommend both
absolutely.
Books. Gary's will start conversations or end them. I don't know. Julie Phillips will open your eyes.
It's engrossing.
Eyes to not just Tiptree Sheldon herself, but to what was going on, especially in the feminist SF movement.
Well, that's it. It's a biography of Tiptree, but it's as really good biographies are, it's set against the wider picture of what's happening in the world around Alice Sheldon.
So I highly recommend it. I think we should do a non-fiction next year. So
I think we should.
Requests, please, send them through. Mm. Look, we're keeping this podcast going because
there won't be one for
at least 12 weeks.
Alas.
Curse is less upset than me. So what you can do over the periods that we're not around is just repeat this podcast over and over again.
Or, older ones if you haven't listened to the whole lot.
Or better yet.
Or re-listen to them. Or you can listen to Sean the Bloggernaut's new podcast.
Or you can listen to Sean the Bloggernaut's new podcast.
Or you can.
Certain Coot Street will still be popping them out.
Galactic Suburbia is on hiatus too. They're on vacation.
I haven't heard of Galactic
for the first time in since they started.
Weeks.
Well, that's it. They've not been doing them. Yeah. They've been on vacation.
I mean, I'm nearly caught up with all my box cutters.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I'm up to April. In that time, that 12 weeks, you, dear listener, have a job. You must read Infinite Jest because we're still fucking doing that.
We're actually doing it, aren't we?
Yeah, because we haven't. Now you're all thinking, they're not going to do it. No, we are fucking doing it by David Foster Wallace or The House of Leaves by Daniel. Is it Daniel?
Mark K. Danielewski.
I knew there was a Daniel in there somewhere. Mark K. Danielewski, yes. You must read those two books. In fact, if you don't read those two books, we just won't do the podcast.
Yeah, we're not coming back.
No, that's it.
Need to read them. And we'll know. We're like Santa Claus. We will know.
We will know. And on that note, if you celebrate Christmas, have a Merry Christmas. If you celebrate Hanukkah, that was last week, so you missed it. If you listen to this podcast now. If you celebrate...
Happy Festivus to everyone else.
No, well, there's other Kwanzaa and there's other things as well. Happy Festivus to everyone else. We hope you have a lovely year. Happy New Year. If you're moving house, do it safely. Mm. If you're going overseas, do it safely. If you're going to Perth, try to keep away from your in-laws. And
if you're reading Infinite Jest, do it safely.
Yes.
It's a heavy book.
It is.
Don't drop it on your toe.
Is that it? Is that all we've got to say?
I think that's all we've got.
Yeah. All right.
It's been a long year. I'm looking forward to next year. I think next year might be better.
We have to do our normals, so please.
Our normals. I should really just pre-record them and whack them on at the end after the music, shouldn't I?
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Anyway, keep going.
Please send
as you were.
Please send feedback to. See, this is the problem. Can I just say something? It says please send feedback to, and then follow us on. So they don't.
I didn't edit it from the beginning. I just whacked it on, so you can just like.
So.
What you should do is be professional, and you should read it in your head before you read it aloud, and make the requisite editorials in your head.
Follow us on Twitter, Writer and Critic. Comment at website, writerandcritic.podbean.com. Email writerandcritic@gmail.com and ratings on iTunes, 5 stars.
If you love us, if you don't, that's fine too. You can give us 1 star.
Happy New Year, happy Christmas, happy everything. Have a safe and healthy whatever. I'm off.
Eat lots of gingerbread.
Or bake it first and then eat it.
Otherwise you'd be eating dough.
Well, I actually noticed you haven't made any gingerbread for months.
Do you know how busy I've been?
Freight train.
Yeah.
What was that about dough? Anyway, see ya.
Bye.
Bye.